Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup for December 19th, 2018. My name's Marty Bennett, and I'm your host and founder of SMIE Consulting. And today we'll be covering a wide range of topics in international education that reared their heads this week in our news feeds around the world. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at two countries, China and India, and their particular relationships with the United States and how those are changing and morphing over time and are impacted by leadership on both ends. And we'll also look at a very special relationship, a very interesting relationship between Education USA, the U.S. State Department, and educational agents around the world. And we'll take a look at those today in some landmark news that occurred at the AIRC conference a week or so ago in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I had the pleasure of being down at the conference for my first time this past week, and had the opportunity to attend that conference
at the
and
AIRC
see what was
conference
happening in the
a week or so
field
ago
as it
in
relates to educational
Fort
agents.
Lauderdale, Florida.
So we're really seeing an interesting shift as it relates to Education USA and agents, and we'll talk a bit about that and what that means for institutions and how and for certainly Education USA. So appreciate you joining me today. For those of you who are not familiar with SMIE Consulting, it's my business I started 4 years ago, almost 5 years ago now, after I left Education USA, and where I took a more proactive approach to consulting, both with companies and institutions in the United States, and working with the British Council, Hot Courses, U.S. News Global Education, and others over the past 4 or 5 years. And I'm now taking it to the next level, particularly with this midweek roundup and our e-newsletter that, for those of you who are following me already through our e-newsletter, all the SMIE news fit to print. Glad to have you a part of that community, and I certainly encourage more of you to sign on, and I'll put out the subscription link for that later today at the end of the podcast. For those of you who are also watching live on Facebook, thank you for joining me today. We do post these to a playlist on YouTube, our YouTube channel for SMIE Consulting. And we also, for those who don't care to watch me during the podcast, we have the audio stream available on iTunes, Google Play, and all your favorite podcast providers. So, what are we talking about today? First up, well, no place other than to start with the news out of the AIRC conference last week regarding Education USA. There was a panel session that had representatives of U.S. Commercial Service as well as U.S. Department of State, particularly Assistant Secretary Casagrande and the Branch Chief for Education USA, Fred Bowles. And during this session, this is actually, for those who aren't familiar, Education USA has had, through State Department, a long-standing policy of their advising centers in the wide world not working with agents directly because they felt that educational agents did not represent, because of the financial incentives involved in their work, did not represent the true breadth of institutions that were available to every student, international student that was looking at the United States as an option. So that's been written policy for a number of years with Education USA. And ever since AIRC started in 2008, this was the 10th anniversary conference this past week, there has been an attempt on behalf of AIRC and others to better engage with Education USA, with the Department of State, in dialogue on the issue of agents. And this is the first time in the 10 years of the AIRC conference that representatives of the State Department and Education USA attended the event. And at that event, during that panel session with Commerce and State Department officials, the Assistant Secretary of State, in question and answers, was asked about how Education USA advising centers would treat institutions that worked with agents differently than they would institutions that did not work with agents. And the impact that has had on the international ed world, particularly in the United States, is pretty significant. Now, as for the, in full disclosure, I worked at Education USA at IIE for 6 years, and this issue was a regularly a part of discussions in terms of why Education USA did not work with agents. Certainly was a policy that caused a lot of consternation, particularly for universities that were looking to Education USA for some guidance and perhaps some advice on agents as part of their mix of enrollment, international enrollment options. And this is something that I think is a step forward for the network, certainly in terms of its relationships with of the full range of U.S. institutions that are actively recruiting international students. But there are going to be some challenges in implementation, to be very honest with you. From reports from the field, this was not a decision that where there was any consultation with advisors or regional coordinators in the field. It was kind of dropped on them when it was announced at the conference. So this is raising some eyebrows in Education USA circles for certain, certainly amongst the advising community, who can rightly feel like this was they were blindsided by this decision. Certainly wouldn't be the first time that this has happened. Certainly in government bureaucracies, particularly at State Department, decisions are made without much consultation down the chain. So that's not unusual. Certainly, how this will manifest itself in implementation is another story entirely. And what we are looking at in terms of Education USA and agents and how those relationships will work moving forward, there are a lot of potential stumbling blocks. Let's just talk about a couple. One of which is the host organizations that employ these advisors around the world. They may have their own policies regarding their staff working with agents. This policy is meant to broaden the scope of international cooperation, international education cooperation between the State Department and other actors, not just agents, but for-profit companies that are eager to help connect students with opportunities in the United States, and how broadly that definition will be interpreted. There's still a lot of details to be decided on this topic. Aside from the issue of host organizations and their policies on whether their staff who are employed as advisors, as part or whole of their job responsibilities, you have the other issues of, okay, which agents, if you're gonna go that route, which agents are your staff now gonna be allowed to work with? So there are probably many others out there, but other issues that will percolate to the surface in the coming weeks and months. But you look at this major issue, I think, which will force, I think, State Department, Education USA to become more proactive in this fight, in the fight for studying in the United States and what that means. But it also, when you look at how educational agents are the images that educational agents have in the marketplace. We're looking at individuals and companies from mom and pop shops around the world to major corporations like IDP that have agencies, major agencies in a number of countries. What kinds of agents will be allowed to work with Education USA advisors, or will Education USA advisors be required to work with locally? And the question is, if you open the door completely to any agent who says they are to work with Education USA, then you have some significant challenges, I think, in terms of how you implement that because of the sheer volume that is expected. When you think about what Education USA provides in general terms, you're looking at the free, unbiased services of information related to higher education options for prospective students. What does that translate to? What Education USA has done is they have opened up their website and a number of the resources that had previously been restricted to institutional representatives of universities, U.S. universities, staff members of universities. They've now opened up that access to the resources of Education USA, which I think is a very good thing because there's tremendous content on that site that has been developed through over the years through advisors and regional coordinators. And there's great value in that, having a wider distribution. Certainly, the Your Five Steps to U.S. study has always been a signature piece of Education USA's material for students, and hopefully that kind of material has wider distribution now through agents and some of the resources that are available now to all who want access to them related to the U.S. higher ed process. So I think there's great value there. The challenge, again, is in the on the ground for advising centers that are would now be have agents that will be knocking on their doors asking, well, you're now supposed to work with us. What is it? What can you do for us? Or how can we work with you? A lot of those details are still yet to be determined. But I think part of a next step is going to be for Education USA to more heavily engage and set up standards for obviously which agents, what kind of agents are, do you have to be an AIRC certified agent, or which tends to be fairly limiting since there's a fairly hefty fee involved with becoming an accredited agent through or certified agent through AIRC, or do you have to be trained, have gone through a education training program, maybe through ICEF? Or as a colleague commented to me this morning, or came if there are established in-country agent organizations, or like in China, there's BASA. Is that going to be an agent? Is that going to be an organization for standards for agents in China that U.S. and Education USA and U.S. Institutions can turn to and say, okay, if agents are a member of this group, then they can work with Education USA offices. So there's a lot of details that have yet to be made public. Certainly at the time of this podcast and live chat, there has not been any changes to the Education USA site where that policy resides, that agency prohibition policy. So it's going to be interesting to see how this develops. So definitely going to be keeping a close eye on this. Been having spent so much of my professional career working with Education USA advisors, I know that this is a decision that will certainly impact their lives directly. And I wonder how they are feeling in this. I certainly know that there's a great sense of uneasiness about this. So I wonder what next steps will be on that front. So keep eyes tuned on and eyes peeled for more on that story. If you haven't already seen that story, that was a great piece that broke with the Pi News this past week. It was also covered on Inside Higher Ed. But certainly Pi News, having staff, Amy Baker was on the scene in Fort Lauderdale for that conference. So she and her team got the scoop on that one before the rest of the major press have. And other than Inside Ed, it hasn't really received a lot of other attention in the higher ed press. So we'll be interested to see what happens next on that front. Now, we mentioned China a moment or two ago. China, as we all know, is certainly the target of a lot of attention from this current administration as it relates to tariffs and potential espionage and a lot of other factors that have complicated and muddied that relationship between the U.S. and China in the past few months. Certainly, we have heard the restrictions that the Trump administration put in place on Chinese researchers and students in certain fields, particularly STEM fields, research-intensive fields, sensitive fields of study, and what that might mean for the United States. So the visa restrictions would limit the length of their visas from 5 down to 1 year maximum for Chinese scholars and students in those particular sensitive fields. And I'm posting a link to an article that came out in the Council of Foreign Relations website this past week. It's a guest blog from a student intern from Barnard College in New York City. And she basically takes the approach that the Trump administration is wrong about Chinese international students in the United States. She goes through all the stories about the visa restrictions and how these students and scholars now, the data is showing that 80% of Chinese students are now returning home after studies. It was a 2017 study compared to only 3 out of 10 in 2007. So 10 years on, there's a much greater percentage of Chinese returning, primarily because of better educational opportunities perhaps at home. But that's certainly one piece of one layer of the China relationship that is quite getting quite a bit of press in recent days and weeks. Another side of it is something we're seeing an increase on in the last few days. This story from Inside Higher Ed shows that the University of Michigan is going to be closing its Confucius Institute when their contract expires with that institute. And this is now a growing trend. There are Confucius Institutes at approximately about 100 universities in the United States. And as of today's date with the Michigan closure, that I think brought to 8 or 9 the number of campuses that are closing their Confucius Institutes or have closed or will be closing their Confucius Institutes. And I've just seen another story early this week that the University of Rhode Island will be following suit and become, I think, the 10th or 11th institution to close its Confucius Institutes. Now, for those unfamiliar with the Confucius Institutes, these are funded by the Chinese government to promote Chinese culture, understanding of Chinese culture and awareness on college campuses and in the communities where these campuses are located. And it's been received, initially was received with open arms by institutions that were looking to, again, as part of their mission, international education mission, broaden understanding of different cultures, and certainly these institutes provided additional resources for campus communities, but there in implementation there's been some issues with academic freedom for staff that worked at these particular institutes, and in certainly the highest levels of governments there's been suspicions about these institutes being served as instruments of the Chinese military-industrial complex and spying and all of these other things that accusations that have been thrown out. So a lot to process with the Confucius Institutes in terms of their future. Now with 10% of them being closed or closing, it's going to be interesting to see what the future holds for Confucius Institutes in the United States as part of that larger U.S.-China relationship, that very complicated U.S.-China relationship. A third piece about China that popped as well in this week's news came out of UC Santa Barbara. Not sure if many of you have seen this story, but you've probably heard stories like this over the past 2 to 3 years, maybe longer, where the headline of the story is, as UC Santa Barbara enrolls more students from China, professors complain about cheating and English skills. This has been something that we've seen other examples of that we've profiled in the last couple of weeks here on the midweek roundup. But there's also other cases around the country that have occurred, not just in the United States. In Australia was the article that we I think highlighted last week. So there's some interesting things that are developing here. And with regards to the UC system, there's certainly been huge expansion in the number of international students at UC schools in the past decade. You just look at all UC campuses in the article, the UC Santa Barbara article, there's a comparison from 2008 to 2017 of all Chinese students enrolled at UC campuses. In 2008, there were 2,600 Chinese students on campus at UC schools. In 2017, so a decade later, we're looking at over 22,000. So humongous increase in the amount of Chinese students attending UC schools. And that comes with any significant growth like this from any one country, but particularly China, because it is the number one sender of students to the United States and a number of other countries around the world. But particularly China, you've seen issues. We did a story last week looking at the Chronicle of Higher Ed's piece by Karen Fisher on the impact of Chinese students on college towns in the United States, looking at East Lansing, Michigan, at Michigan State, where their Chinese population has grown by leaps and bounds. Also Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois, their population is enormous in terms of their Chinese students. So there's some real significant impacts when you have this large of a concentration from any one country on campus in terms of your international student populations, but also your broader population of students. And at the UC schools are certainly no exception. The issue at UC Santa Barbara was that students, Chinese students, were not prepared enough academically, or not academically necessarily, but with their English language proficiency to handle the courses. There was an institution where an art professor, this is kind of the focus of the initial story, an art professor was visiting a colleague's class as a guest lecturer last year, and he was seeing students who slept, played with their phones, or left for restrooms and didn't come back. And this particular professor noticed that many of the offenders were international students from China. So he came to class one day and put a PowerPoint up with a set of rules that says, turn off your phones, go to the bathroom now. And he spelled out his expectations in English and Chinese, in Mandarin. So students were shocked. Some students gasped, others shrugged it off, quoting from the article. Several students snapped photos of the list and posted them on Chinese language social media. And you can imagine what happens from there with social media. So this story certainly had, in the LA Times, certainly was painted the picture that a number of these students that are coming to the U.S., particularly from China, were not the most focused students. So we're seeing issues here, how institutions respond to these issues is an important piece of the puzzle here, because as one of the comments in the article was, if you are going to admit these students and take their money, you got to take care of them. And whether they were preparing so hard for tests, they learned how to take a particular test, and they really weren't as proficient with their spoken or written English as maybe they understand it when they read it, but they don't necessarily write it or speak it well. That's a whole different story, and that addresses in how institutions admit international students as well. Brings up a lot of other issues there. So with China, that relationship is clearly going to be one to will develop and evolve as time goes along. But that story and these stories about the Confucius Institutes, the espionage piece, the visa piece, and the preparedness of Chinese students at some of these schools is something that's going to be a common theme, I think, in the weeks and months to come that we'll hear. Now, for the last topic of the day, we're going to switch gears and talk about India. India is one of those countries. If you've recruited there, you know what a complex mix of students and emotions and scents and experiences you have there, range from the most beautiful to the absolute ugliest imaginable that you could experience in traveling there. But certainly the good far outweighs the bad in terms of every experience I've ever had with the Indian students, Indian culture, and certainly with regard to how Indian students are perceived in the United States, how they perceive us, how we perceive them. This is a complex issue as well, much like it is with China. But what we see from India, we've had some topics on the midweek roundup on India before, where we've talked about their obsession with careers and post-study work. We've talked about that quite a bit, and that is reflected in some of the stories we'll be covering today related to India and that relationship, and really looking at what is driving Indian students abroad. Now, we announced last week the new policy change regarding H-1Bs in the United States. And I mentioned at the time how it's going to be curious to see how that's received in India. We have a first hint of that from the Hindu business line. That Hindu is a national media outlet in India. And they had an article this past week that looked at this story and called the switch, if you remember from the H-1B issue last week. They're switching how, or prioritizing how applicants are going to be reviewed, that preference will be given to U.S. Degree holders that have U.S. degree, master's or Ph.D. degrees will be given preference. Whereas in the past, they were kind of confined to a $20,000 extra quota that existed for those who had advanced degrees from U.S. institutions. That is now going to be looked at in the whole process of the 85,000 H-1B visas, that for that whole number now, that students who applicants for H-1Bs who have done master's or doctorates in the United States will be given preference. And the article seemed to make reference from doing the math, as one is wont to do when they look at the numbers, that roughly 10,000 fewer visas will go to applicants, H-1B applicants, who have their master's or doctorates from outside the United States. And they call it a clever switch, because what it means is it will benefit from this article's case, their statement is, you can do the math, 16% of 65,000 is 10,400 visas, which will now simply be taken away from NASSCOM. NASSCOM is one of the companies that is kind of a facilitator for Indians who are looking to get H-1B visas in the United States direct from India, from their work experience in India, or their university experience in India. So these 10,000 plus visas will now be taken away from this company that facilitates those visas and awarded to Indians in the United States, Indian students in the United States. So assuming that no other country would have students applying for H-1Bs. But the interesting thing is that he's not too far wrong on that statement, because over 70% of all H-1Bs in the United States currently are Indians, not just students who have come for degrees first and then gone to work, but also Indians that have come direct. So there will be some changes, and that's interesting to see how that is viewed moving forward from the Indian perspective. Also want to look at Indian students that do come to the United States. For those who have traveled in India, those who have regularly received and reviewed applications from India, you notice a large concentration of them, no doubt, coming from the Andhra Pradesh region and Telangana. Telangana is actually a new state in India that was created around Hyderabad in the south of India. As a result, a new consulate was created there 10 years ago. U.S. consulate was created there 10 years ago, and this is where the lion's share of Indian applicants, particularly student visa applicants, come from in India as they go through the consul general in Hyderabad. It was opened in 2008, and it's issued 1.73 lakh visas in 2017. It's one of the top 10 busiest U.S. visa issuing posts in the world. And that is also it's a sign of the growth of the Hyderabad region. Major American companies have bases there or operations there: Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Amazon, Google, Uber, Apple, to mention a few. So we're looking at just a huge operation in Hyderabad. But what we've seen and is that from that region, and this is something I always want more to dive deeper with colleagues in India, and I'm posting the link to that story in the Facebook page now. When I look at India and all of the student interest, the parent interest, and the questions that get asked, you almost always hear first or second about what are OPT, H-1B prospects, job opportunities for me, if I'm coming from India to the United States, what are my chances of getting a job? And those of you who've worked with students, Indian students, once they've gotten to campus, you can certainly relate to this, that's a very common theme. And certainly, I've always wondered what's behind that, what's driving that for Indians coming abroad, particularly to the United States. And this past week, there was also an ICIF Monitor story that revealed the results of a couple of QS studies and surveys that surveyed prospective Indian students on their perspectives on studying abroad, not just to the United States but other countries as well, and career prospects and employability were chief drivers. The competition in the Indian job market is a major factor that was driving them abroad. And having multiple degrees and strong interest in helping to further build the Indian economy as reasons why Indians come abroad to study. And now, the employability piece I certainly get, and that's something that certainly resonates and in the industry and certainly with the numbers from STEM OPT, where 80% of Indians in the United States that are on OPT are STEM students. They want that extra couple of years of work experience, and 70% plus of H-1Bs are Indian. So the data certainly reflects that is the trend. These are the motivating factors. Whereas you see in China, what has started to develop in China with prospects for employment prospects for Chinese graduates of U.S. institutions being now better back home than here necessarily in the United States, you see fewer Chinese staying and more going home. That's not the case with India. It's the exact opposite. You see many more Indians wanting to stay for OPT, hopefully H-1B, then permanent residency, and potentially citizenship someday. So that those employability factors, the competition of the Indian job market, the desire to improve situation back home are certainly common themes, and I think that's really, really interesting to see. And one last story I'll leave you with today is a guest column by a former Indian student who came to the United States to study at Vanderbilt back in 2000, and his journey to not only H-1B, but eventually to a permanent residency and now citizenship. His journey is one over 18 years it's taken him to become going through the student system, work system, and then permanent residency, and now becoming a citizen. He talks about his journey, and something that I certainly agree with. Anyone who's done immigration advising with international students over the past 20 years knows the challenges of the system, that it is definitely a system geared towards proving students from the beginning having to prove a negative, that they're not planning to emigrate to the United States and stay, that they are planning to return home. In other countries, there are now dual intent, where you can come for both a study and potential employment after and residency afterwards. Canada certainly moved in that direction. New Zealand has their pathways to that extent in Australia as well. So the argument in this gentleman's column is for dual intent student visa category, to make F-1s dual intent and allow for the opportunity to then stay after graduation, then work, and then become permanent residencies without the potential hassles and hiccups they have and experience on the front end of the process. So a very informative article, and I encourage you all to read those. For those that, are listening on the podcast, you can find the links to these stories on the SMIE Consulting LLC Facebook page. Or if you'd like, you can subscribe to our SMIE, all the SMIE news that's fit to share e-newsletter. And I'm posting the links to those on the Facebook page as well. But you can also find that on the subscribe page on our social media and international education website, consulting website. That is a great resource, again, for those that are looking to find more out about what we do at SMIE. But also great resources, free resources that are available for those that are looking to dig a little bit deeper into their institution's international enrollment management plans. So thanks for all of you for joining me today, and I appreciate getting the chance to share my thoughts on these important issues, and encourage you to catch up with us on the archive section here on the Facebook page, on our YouTube channel, or on the podcast for SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. This is Marty Bennett signing off for today, and we wish you the best of luck. And we will be taking a break next week for the Christmas holidays, and we'll be back with you in the last week of December, beginning of January. Thanks again for joining us. Take care.